This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
It's a full show for you this week on Radio EcoShock. Super scientist Mark Jacobson from Stanford University explains soot causing warming, plus a way to run the world on clean energy by 2030. We visit an ultra-mega coal power plant in India, 10 times larger than U.S. stations. It's already killing people and threatening the planet. The show wraps with Manzoor Kadir on the farm soil loss larger than France just since 1990. You won't believe what's killing the land. I'm Alex Smith. Mark, you've researched and published on a ton of issues we cover here on Radio EcoShock. In our limited time, let's try to hit some of the main points. I'd like to start off with your detailed knowledge of what's in our atmosphere, including the air we breathe. And then let's get to your plan for a world run entirely by renewable energy by the year 2030. So at last count, you've published over 100 scientific papers in the Journal of Geophysical Research alone. And in just one example, you found 18% of all carbon emissions come from a source most environmentalists hardly ever think about. Tell us about burning biomass. What is that?
Well, there's different types of biomass, but the biomass that we've been looking at is what's called open biomass burning. So that's just forests and savanna and woodlands. Savanna, for example, is burned for a ritual, but forests are burned often for permanent deforestation to create grazing land and ranch land and farmland. And when you burn that land, you not only put carbon in the air, but you also put a lot of pollution into the air. And well, if it's not permanent deforestation, then some of that carbon grows back as in the form of new trees or new vegetation, although there's a time lag between burning and regrowth, so you always have some additional carbon in the atmosphere. But regardless, when you do burn, whether it's permanent or non-permanent, you put pollutants into the air, and that causes hundreds of thousands of premature mortalities per year worldwide just from open biomass burning. There's other type of burning, which is biofuel burning. There's solid biofuels such as waste and dung and for home heating and cooking in developing countries primarily. And this is actually even a larger cause of human mortality worldwide because this burning is done inside homes where children are exposed. So worldwide, around 3 to 5 million people die prematurely just from indoor burning, air pollution from indoor burning of biomass for biofuels for heating and cooking. And then there's outdoor air pollution as well that causes another 1 million to 2 million deaths per year. Worldwide, total, there are about anywhere from 3 to 7 million premature deaths per year from air pollution from all these sources, open biomass burning, biofuel burning, and fossil fuel burning.
I was under the impression that the amount of sun blocked by biomass soot, known as global dimming, made this a cooling force rather than causing global warming. What did we miss?
Well, so particles in the air from pollution particles, they can cause either warming or cooling. If they're dark particles, such as what's called brown carbon or black carbon, those particles absorb solar radiation or sunlight and then heat up the air around them. And this differs from greenhouse gases, which are transparent to sunlight but absorb infrared radiation from the Earth's surface and trap that radiation below the particles. But it turns out these dark particles cause about a million times more warming per unit mass than greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide do. So they're very effective. But there are other types of particles that are reflective, such as made of sulfate and nitrate and then water that gets associated with those particles, and also ammonium and certain organic carbon as well. And it turns out worldwide of all the particles in the air, about 80% of them are cooling, what I call cooling particles, and the rest are the warming particles or dark particles. And the cooling particles, they offset or mask a lot of the warming that's going on. So if you look worldwide at the total, all the causes of global warming, well, global warming today, it's been about 0.8 to 0.9 degrees Celsius or Kelvin. And that's really due to warming by greenhouse gases, and fossil fuel soot and biofuel soot particles, black carbon and brown carbon, that the sum of which exceeds the warming that's observed, and the difference is the cooling particles, which mask warming, almost half the warming of the greenhouse gases plus the dark particles. Now, biomass, when you burn it, it produces both dark particles and cooling particles. And even though there are more cooling particles emitted even by biomass burning, the dark particles are actually more effective at warming than we previously thought. The reason is because not only do they warm the air directly, but they get inside of clouds. And when they get in clouds, they burn off the clouds. And then also when they deposit onto snow and sea ice, they darken the snow and sea ice and melt them faster. So when you actually account for those particles and the fact that when you burn biomass, you're actually heating the air directly just from the burning, that when you account for those effects were not accounted for before. Previous studies of biomass burning just looked at mostly cooling particles and their impacts without looking at the warming particles or their impacts on clouds or snow. And so they concluded that the biomass burning was causing a net cooling of climate in the short term, but a warming of the climate in the long term due to the greenhouse gases. But a more recent study that we did looked at the impacts of both the cooling particles and the warming particles and the impacts of the warming particles on clouds and snow and sea ice, as well as the heating of the air and the direct heat released by the burning, and found that there's actually, even in the short term, you get a net warming of climate due to biomass burning the whole thing.
Mark, some of us have concerns that if something shuts down the industrial system and low-level pollution sources clear up, in a few weeks the world could experience a burst of heating that was masked by that smog. Is that a legitimate concern, do you think?
Well, technically that would happen, yes. If you cleaned up all the particles in the air worldwide, the warming and cooling particles, you would have a burst of heating because of this reduction of the masking that's occurring. However, from a practical point of view, you're not going to be able to shut down all the pollution worldwide, particularly in developing countries. But we do have that goal of doing that. But see, so the solution then is to not only eliminate all the particles, but you have to eliminate all the greenhouse gases as well simultaneously. And even doing that, you might get a short-term burst of a small amount of heating, but within a few years, everything would start cooling more rapidly, and so you can actually come back to the situation you really want, which is a stable climate.
And your paper talks about Arctic ice. If the pollution is coming from the industrial zones of Asia, North America, and Europe, how does it get to the Arctic, and how serious is the impact there?
Well, pollution particles have a lifetime on the order of a week to a few weeks, and so over the course of a week, particles can actually travel around the globe, and they're removed primarily by rain. And so even though winds travel primarily from west to east, they do meander north and south as well. So you do get some transport of pollution to the north, especially pollutants that are emitted in northern latitudes, such as Canada and Europe. A lot of those pollutants in Russia, those pollutants are the ones that get to the Arctic primarily. But even pollutants emitted at the latitudes of the United States and even further south, just due to the circulation system, can get to the Arctic. Now, greenhouse gases, on the other hand, are much longer lived, and they become well mixed globally just because they last for years.
Have you seen the photographs of black in Greenland taken by Dr. Jason Box for the Dark Snow Project?
Yes, I've seen photographs of really dark snow in Greenland. Yeah, it's pretty incredible.
Well, Mark Zett Jacobson, you are one of the experts in the real content of the air we breathe, and I've just read about a new study showing pregnant women should stay away from traffic to have better odds of good lungs in their children. How big is the health impact of running this civilization on fossil fuels?
Well, it's serious. I mean, traffic is a very serious problem in terms of intake of pollution. Not all pollution is the same. More people are exposed to traffic pollution, for example, than power plant pollution because you're just so close to the sources in traffic. And the main problems with traffic exhaust are diesel particles coming out of trucks and buses. But even regular cars, even though they're more efficient and emit a lot less, they still produce some particles, and they produce gases that turn into particles over time. So it's pretty dangerous. In the United States, all air pollution from both traffic and power plants and every other fossil fuel source causes the premature death of about 60 to 65,000 people per year. And this costs the U.S. about $500 billion per year, around a little over 3% of its GDP. Now, worldwide, air pollution mortalities are much larger. There are about 3 to 7 million people per year die prematurely, and a lot of them are from indoor burning of biofuels for heating and cooking. And about 20% of the deaths are children under the age of 5 years old worldwide.
And I've had reports, you know, of teachers where 20% of the kids can hold up their asthma inhalers in a class in New York City. So when it comes to clearing up the air for public health and to reduce global warming, where are the low-hanging fruits? Where can we affordably and quickly act to make a difference?
Well, there's things that individuals can do, but there are also policy mechanisms that can be put in place to really enhance a large-scale conversion of the whole energy infrastructure. So individuals can certainly be more efficient in their appliances. They buy light bulbs, getting an electric car, which uses one-fifth the energy to drive than a gasoline or diesel car. Using heat pumps instead of gas for heating. Same thing for water heating. You can use heat pump water heaters instead of gas water heaters. Weather stripping your home, being more efficient in terms of transportation, ride sharing. So there are a lot of things that individuals can do. But at the policy level, we really need a large scale conversion of the energy infrastructure. And so that requires policies to incentivize clean renewable energy, such as wind and solar power and geothermal power, hydroelectric to the extent it exists, but to try to improve its efficiency. And tidal wave power are the electric power sources, but also then in transportation, going to electric vehicles, to some extent hydrogen fuel cell vehicles, for heating and cooling, as I mentioned, heat pumps and some electric resistance heating, and then for industry, going to electricity also in terms of heating, for either resistance heating or hydrogen. So everything in the end would be run on electricity, which would reduce power demand in the United States by about 30% just due to the efficiency of electricity over combustion and without even changing our habits. But then we can get another anywhere from 5 to 25% reduction of power demand by energy efficiency measures. But in order to get this change, we really need policymakers to incentivize the growth of clean electric power generation, as well as clean transportation, heating, cooling.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, talking with a scientist and director of the Atmosphere and Energy Program at Stanford University, Mark Jacobson. Mark, I can hardly mention solar or wind power on this program without getting a few emails warning about all the fossil fuels required to make solar panels or wind machines. Do we really gain energy and save emissions with these technologies?
Yes, definitely. With regard to wind, a wind turbine can run for about 30 years, and it takes about 4 months, maybe 6 months in low wind locations of running to actually generate the energy it needs to produce the turbine itself, to build the turbine itself. So it's basically about 98 to 99% carbon free. If you assume that that energy for that 6 months really came from fossil fuels, 4 to 6 months. But even over time, as we replace the energy infrastructure, less and less of that energy that's used to create the turbine will be from fossil fuels. For example, already in the United States, about 12.5 to 13% of all electric power generation is already clean. So, you know, we've already eliminated 13% of those emissions for building a turbine. And as we penetrate more wind and solar, let's say we get up to 50%, then only half the generation of a wind turbine, production of a wind turbine, will be from fossils. Now, with solar, it's more energy intensive to build the solar PV. If it's photovoltaics, it can take up to 1 year instead of 4 months to 6 months, 1 year in high solar locations and longer if it's kind of a weak solar location, to regenerate the power that it needed to produce the solar panels. But for concentrated solar power, it's actually closer to wind because the materials needed are just concrete and steel, basically, and sand for mirrors. So it's not very energy intensive.
You had a great article in Scientific American in 2009 called A Path to Sustainable Energy by 2030, and you mentioned a couple of hurdles to getting there, and the first was a possible shortage of relatively rare elements required for production. Just tell us briefly about that.
Yeah, well, we examined whether there was a limitation in terms of materials for any of the technologies we are looking at, including, well, primarily, for example, wind turbines or solar photovoltaics or even lithium for batteries for electric vehicles. And so, for example, wind turbine permanent magnets require an element neodymium. But it turns out that if we wanted to power half the entire world with wind, we would need about 4 million large wind turbines, and that would only take up about 1/7 of the neodymium supply that's known already worldwide, and there might be lots of other supply that we haven't even found yet. So that was not a limitation. In terms of solar photovoltaics, there are some elements for some types of photovoltaics that are limiting, at least based on known resources, but there are so many different types of photovoltaics. If there is a limitation, we can always just use a different type of photovoltaic. And for lithium, there's enough known resources. I mean, right now there are about 800 million vehicles in the world, and there are enough known resources of lithium for over 2 or 2.5 billion vehicles. And so there's really no limitation at this point for lithium. And if there is shortages, you just have a recycling system. Well, we should do recycling anyway. That would really control the waste of lithium.
Well, the second big barrier you mentioned was social, especially finding the political will. We have to tell all the oil and coal workers their jobs are obsolete. The richest people in the world, like the Koch brothers, have to give up their fossil-fueled wealth. It would be a real tragedy, Mark, if we had the technology to make a livable climate but couldn't make that change socially.
Yeah, well, in terms of jobs, so we did a calculation if we converted the entire United States energy infrastructure, state by state, to wind, water, and solar for all sectors. We had calculated that over the U.S., we would create about 5 million 40-year construction jobs and 2.5 million 40-year operation jobs, and we'd lose about 4 million fossil fuel plus nuclear jobs. So there's a net gain over 40 years of 2.5 million jobs. So it's, in some cases, it would require retraining, but it would actually be a net benefit in terms of jobs. In terms of the money, like the Koch brothers, you know, they've gotten their investments already, so they can certainly take their investments and just shift them without losing any money. There's a lot of sunk infrastructure, and so certainly we should be cognizant of that, and we don't want communities to be destroyed. So that's why there's job retraining would be required. It comes down to the social issue is such that it's people who have a vested interest in the current infrastructure are going to fight it the most. And this is unfortunate, but usually it's the fears that these people bring up of losses are, they're not societal losses. Society will gain as a whole for sure, especially in terms of reduced air pollution, mortalities and its effects, reduced global warming. You'll stabilize the energy prices as well because the fuel cost of wind and solar and hydroelectric and geothermal are zero, whereas fossil fuels are finite and rising prices over time. So you expect to keep the cost down from wind, water, solar. In fact, you can see that in data right now. The 10 states in the U.S. with the highest fraction of their electricity from wind in the last 5 years, the cost of electricity in those states declined 0.4%. All the other states increased their price of electricity 8%, and those are ones relying on fossil fuels primarily. So you stabilize the prices, and you create jobs, and you eliminate warming, and you eliminate air pollution mortality. So there's really very little downside of doing this conversion. It's something that will create a sustainable energy infrastructure for our future.
And what about the loss of birds and bats to the wind turbines and the 90,000 solar plants?
Every wind turbine you put up decreases bird kills by a factor of 10. The reason is because natural gas and coal kill 10 times more birds per kilowatt hour than wind does. And they kill the birds through not only air pollution, but also through the land degradation during mining and the habitat destruction, but also the buildings that birds crash into. And so there's a factor of 10 higher bird deaths due to gas and coal and wind. And so every time you displace a gas plant or coal plant with a wind farm, then you reduce bird kills by a factor of 10. And birds in the United States, the American Bird Conservancy and the Fish and Wildlife Service estimate up to 440 to 500,000 birds are killed each year by wind turbines. Now, it sounds like a lot. But they also estimate that communication towers kill 10 to 50 million birds per year, cats are about 80 million birds per year, and buildings are about 1 billion birds per year. So there are a lot of infrastructure that's causing a lot more damage than wind turbines ever will.
Mark, what research are you doing these days as we start to wrap up here?
We do both atmospheric science research, so we look at the impacts of pollutants on climate and human health, and we're developing energy plans for states and countries. So we've developed energy plans for all 50 U.S. states, and you can, in fact, go to a website called, just 100.org, the number 100.org, or also the solutionsproject.org. It's the same thing. So this is a group that is taking our energy plans and trying to educate the public about them and policymakers. So you can go to that website and click on any state, and you can see an energy plan pops up for a state. So we're now expanding that to look at all countries of the world to develop potential clean energy plans for every country, and then working with people to educate the public about it and policymakers as well.
Hope is a dirty word these days, but you're giving me some. I appreciate it. We've been talking with Mark Zed Jacobson, a professor of civil and environmental engineering at Stanford University and director of Stanford's Atmosphere and Energy Program. He's the author of 4 books and over 100 papers on pollution and clean energy solutions. Find links to the topics and papers we've discussed in my weekly Radio EcoShock show blog at ecoshock.info. Mark, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us.
All right. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is the second week of our fall fundraising drive on Radio EcoShock. That's when I try to raise enough money to keep the show going over the Christmas holidays and into the new year. It doesn't cost much, and it doesn't take much. Please visit the About page on our website at ecoshock.org for details, or donate right on the show blog at ecoshock.info. My thanks to the super people who stood up last week and said, "Yeah, this show matters. Let's keep it going." Prepare to enter a world of opposites. That's where a mega coal plant in India is classified as environmentally friendly technology. Where electricity customers in Europe can buy credits from a coal plant as a clean development mechanism. Where hundreds of millions of U.S. taxpayer dollars help build that deadly coal plant. We're going to travel to a small place in the big state of Madhya Pradesh in India. That's the sixth largest state with a population of 72 million people, right in the middle of the country. Our destination is the village of Sasan in the Singrauli district. There we'll find the Sasan Ultra Mega Power Project, one of 4 monster coal-generating stations being built by the Indian government. Unlike other big Indian coal plants, this one is not on the coast, ready to accept coal ships from Indonesia or Australia. The Sasan Power Project is fed by 3 Indian coal mines relatively nearby. Our guide today is Nicole Gio of Sierra Club India. Nicole, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
You've been to the Sasan Ultra Mega Power Project. What does it look like?
Massive. The first time I was there was in April of 2011, and at that point they had only completed construction on a very small part of the project, and it was already huge. I can't even really begin to describe it. But they cleared entire villages of people to make way for the project and build a border wall around the project itself. And that's just the power project. Reliance will not let us into the actual mine site, but I've been able to meet with communities that have been moved to make way for the overburden. This is just mountains and mountains of waste product from the mine itself, which is piled up. And just there's nothing holding it back. So boulders will just run down these piles, destroying homes where people used to live. And if there's any rain, any toxics, anything in those mounds will just run out into the water supply.
What a mess. What was there before this power project started?
Well, the history of Singrauli, that's the district that Sasan sits in, is a pretty dramatic one. It used to be densely forested. Actually, it was a place that people in many ways were afraid to go. It was the jungle. It was out there. But in the 1960s, they built the first large power project, the Rihand Dam. And since then, there have been numerous industrial projects and people have been displaced multiple times. So many of the people have actually been displaced for Sisson. This isn't the first time they've even been displaced for a big industrial project.
And do they get compensation?
That depends. Under Indian law, as well as the IFC performance standards, which the U.S. Export-Import Bank is subject to, they should get compensation. We found reports of discrepancies with the compensation. There are various problems, people either being compensated at levels lower than required, or people who have not received their compensation. Either they were not compensated at all, or you know they've been told checks are in the mail, reliant checks have been issued in the names of family members who are not around, who have died, who have disappeared, and by disappeared I actually mean likely disappeared by the company. So that's been a huge problem that people are dealing with. And then in addition, if you have an entire family that's living on a small plot of land doing subsistence farming, which there actually were some people, if you ever go to Singrauli, you'll see why subsistence farming is very difficult there. But there were still people who were making a living that way. If they're lucky enough to have a title of their land, that will only be in one person's name. There'll be compensation for that one person, but not necessarily for the entire family that's living there. And then if they're relocated to a place where they're given a small amount of money and a place to live, but no land, they have no way to make an income. So as soon as that money runs out, they're pretty much done for.
The Sierra Club says this project is a killer. Why would you say that?
Well, coal-fired power plants, and this is just coal-fired power plants, not mines, estimates are that they kill around 100,000 people in India every year. So that's just a fact. And this is a massive coal plant. It is around 4,000 megawatts. The average U.S. coal plant is around 400 to 500. So we're already talking about a plant that's the scale is almost unimaginable for people in the U.S. And that's going to be emitting a large amount of air pollution that's going to have devastating effects on the local population. And in addition, there's a huge amount of waste product from that. You have the ash pond, which villages have been moved for that. In the U.S., you have people drinking water that's contaminated from ash ponds here. When you're talking about a 4,000 megawatt coal plant in a district that's filled with coal plants that are multi-thousand megawatts, you have serious problems with water contamination. That's something they're already seeing. I mean, I have pictures of a woman who's using a hand pump to get water right next to the ash pond, like 20 feet from the edge of it. And that's her water supply. And then you get to the mine itself and all of the damage that that's caused, both to the water supply and to the people that have been relocated for that project. And of course, then there's the people who've actually died. It can be hard to say that lung disease was caused from a specific coal plant. It's a lot easier to say there was a person who protested the relocation and disappeared, was picked up by the company, we know that, and then was not seen again. If you read the report, there's also people who've protested or complained whose children disappeared in the mine. We have accounts of workers who've died on the project itself. And so those are people who've actually died at the project. And in that sense, the project is very deadly.
How many units are now operating in Sisson? And has the Sierra Club worked out the carbon emissions from this place?
So the project is starting to come online now. There are 6 units total that will be operational. The carbon emissions are intense. I actually don't have the figures in front of me. It was hard for us to get many of those figures from the U.S. Export-Import Bank, which financed $900 million of financing for Sisson. Under federal legislation, as well as the Ex-Im Bank's own policies, they're required to release, upon request, various monitoring documents for the project, none of which they were willing to release to us. We were able to get a hold of the ESIA, the Environmental and Social Impact Assessment for the power project, only part of the ESIA for the mine, and then the greenhouse gas studies for both the mine and the power project. What's interesting is that Sisson actually violated Ex-Im's carbon policies at the time it was approved, and the bank initially rejected the project. They later reversed the decision when Reliance promised to install a few hundred megawatts of clean energy. And somehow that little bit of clean energy was supposed to offset the 4,000 megawatts of dirty coal, and make the project okay. So then Exxon said, look, we're making it better, and approved the project, which is a gross misunderstanding of how the project works.
Now, for any listeners who don't know, can you just tell us in a nutshell, what is the U.S. Export-Import Bank and why are U.S. tax dollars in play?
So the U.S. Export-Import Bank finances overseas business. So it can do a lot of different types of financing. It can do financing with banks, it can do financing of expertise. With Sasan, it's really the classic example where the U.S. Export-Import Bank is actually financing mining equipment. So the U.S. Export-Import Bank provides money to Reliance Power, which is behind the Sasan coal plant and the mine. And then Sasan buys mining equipment from Bucyrus. And that equipment, I believe, is coming from Wisconsin. And then Reliance pays that money back to the U.S. government. So what we're doing is we're, in theory, helping, well, this is the way the Export-Import Bank would put it, is that they're promoting U.S. businesses abroad. The problem is that that is still taxpayer money. Assuming the project is successful, it will be repaid with interest to the U.S. Export-Import Bank. But those are our tax dollars that are financing this project and that are supporting it. What's also troubling is that U.S. Export-Import Bank, or really any export credit agency from any country that's supporting a project like this, it's a vote of confidence in the project. So when the U.S. Export-Import Bank goes and approves a project like Sasan, it's a signal to the private sector that this is a good investment. In theory, EXIM shouldn't be financing something that's risky. So all of a sudden, you have other private financiers that are going to be more secure in getting involved in the project. So it also can be used to leverage financing from other sources.
Now, you mentioned Reliance Power. I've learned that the Sasan mega project is owned by that company, which is part of a business conglomeration owned by Anil Ambani. The families of the two Ambani brothers are listed as the second richest family in the world. The Ambanis are something like India's Koch brothers, I guess you could say. Now, why has India, a country so blessed with solar power resources, decided to build unbelievably large coal plants?
For that, you might have to go and ask the Indian government. The truth is that there is this idea about the way power works, an idea that is fostered by industry. And it's also has been fostered by development associations, although that's changing very rapidly. The idea comes from the way the U.S., Europe, and other Western countries develop. And this is, you know, using technology in the 1800s that was very reliant on coal. So there's this idea that everyone has to develop starting with coal. The problem is that then you're regulating societies to technology from, if not the 1800s, at least the 1900s. The super efficient coal plants are projects that were built in the U.S. in the 1970s. We have the ability now to leapfrog technology. You wouldn't expect to solve the world's telecommunications problems by running landlines everywhere. You know, we skip that step, and in many parts of the world, go straight to cell phones. The same thing could be said with energy, this idea that we have to rely on these dirty sources. The other thing about centralized projects is you really have to look at who they benefit. There's this idea that a centralized coal plant can be built to benefit those who live without energy, which in India is a very real problem. The thing is that centralized coal plants, if you look at the numbers, don't actually do that much to help rural energy poverty. The problem is that to actually address that with a centralized project, you need to deal with the grid. And the grid in India and in many countries is in very bad condition. You have huge losses. And grid extensions are very, very expensive. So you have people who don't have access to electricity, and there's no one who really wants to spend the money to run the grid out to them because that costs money, and that power instead can be sent right into industrial centers. And those are really the people who benefit, are the big industrialists, because they're the ones who are actually getting the power from these projects. And lest you believe that when I'm talking about rural energy poverty, it's people who live a long way from the source. If you go to Singrauli, you see many people who are not connected to the grid. They can live in the shadow of one of these massive coal plants, and they're still not hooked up because there's no company that wants to run a grid 50 feet outside the power project to a small home when they can get so much more money running it hundreds of miles into an industrial center.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm talking with Nicole Guillot. And Sierra Club just teamed up with four other NGOs to publish a report titled The U.S. Export-Import Bank's Dirty Dollars. The subtitle reads, U.S. tax dollars are supporting human rights, environment, and labor violations at the Sasan coal-fired power plant and mine in India. Who are the other groups that teamed up with you for this investigative report?
350.org, Carbon Market Watch, Pacific Environment, and Friends of the Earth U.S.
Nicole Gill, it astounds me that the Sasan coal plant has qualified as a clean development mechanism, or CDM, under the Kyoto Protocol. What does that mean, and how is that justified?
It was justified under the idea that Sasan would be a highly efficient coal plant. And again, as I said earlier, these highly efficient coal plants are things that we were building in the U.S. in the 1970s. It's not necessarily super new technology. But the argument was made that by using efficient technology, we'd actually be reducing emissions over using a subcritical technology. There's a number of problems with that. One is, in many parts of the world, the economics of coal actually make super ultra-critical coal plants more economic because you are generating the same amount of electricity by burning less coal. In the U.S., because coal was so cheap, that wasn't always the case. But in a country like India, where they're relying on imported coal, where there's this vast shortage of domestic coal, they can't dig it up fast enough, all of a sudden these highly efficient coal plants become the go-to as opposed to something that a company might not want to do. The other problem is just the way the coal mechanism was set under the CDM. It vastly, vastly overestimated emission savings. And because of Sasan and other projects, and because attention was drawn to this, the mechanism under the CDM was actually suspended. And since then, it has been reimplemented. So it is technically possible, again, to get coal credits under the CDM, which is absurd. But no project has been approved for carbon credits under the CDM since that change. And that's because, just like you said, it's crazy that a project like this would actually be given carbon credits.
It's not environmentally friendly. Now, the Prime Minister of India, Narendra Modi, did not attend the recent climate change meeting of world leaders in New York City. Is he also dedicated to this vision of coal power for India?
Modi has come with an all-of-the-above approach. He's really said that coal is going to be part of the solution. It has been interesting, though. He's also put a lot of weight behind solar. And I think this is a big shift for India. Every 5 years, you have a new energy plan. And always said, we're going to build all this coal and we're going to solve energy poverty in India. And it kept not happening because, again, these centralized coal plants are very bad at delivering energy access. And for the first time, when you look at India's energy plan under Modi, you're starting to see a huge investment in rooftop solar and in off-grid renewables and clean sources of energy. And the reason for this is that it's purely pragmatic. Modi realizes that to stay in power, he needs to actually put some sort of dent in the levels of energy poverty in India. Centralized coal plants have failed, and there's a model that shows that renewable energy and off-grid and mini-grids can succeed. Now, that being said, Modi is still a big fan of coal. He comes from Gujarat, one of the other ultra-mega power projects that's being built in India. The Tata Mundra plant is in Gujarat as well. So he's definitely a fan of coal. But the reality is finally starting to sink in, and people are starting to realize if you're going to tackle energy poverty, you really have to be looking at these other solutions.
But won't India itself be hit hard by climate change?
Yes. And in fact, its next-door neighbor, Bangladesh, is actually one of the countries that will be hit hardest in the entire world because much of that country is below sea level. India, you're dealing with the monsoons and so many people relying on the monsoons for crops, as well as the number of floods that have happened already in India. These flash floods have killed thousands of people, largely at the base of the mountains. So we're already seeing people die from climate change in India. But at the same time, there is a very real issue of energy poverty and this question of how to juggle it. And it's not going to get better. If all these coal projects are built, you will see more people die.
But it's a huge problem for all of us. I mean, if India, it's the second most populous country in the world, it's projected to become the world's most populous place. If they choose coal as the way to go, we're all going to be in for a climate catastrophe. That's the fear that I have and that I know many of my listeners have.
One thing to remember is that while there are a huge number of coal projects in the pipeline for India, The economics are changing because India does have to address its issues with energy poverty, and no one's going to argue with that. The two big questions, well, the three big questions are climate change, but also what is the best way? What is the most efficient way to address energy poverty? And we've already talked a little bit about that. And also, what's feasible? And you look at India and look at their coal projects, and you're seeing scandals, you're seeing economic instability. And these are things that are really starting to shake up the common beliefs around coal. There was this assumption for so long that coal is cheap, that coal is a good investment, and it was like gravity. That's just the way the world operates. But when you look at India, you're seeing a large number of plants that were proposed to be built on the coast, relying on imported coal, but the price of coal in the international market turned out to be too high for many of those projects. To use Tata Mundra as an example, again, this is a project that was on the verge of bankruptcy, and they actually had to go to the Indian government and ask for permission to charge customers a higher rate to cover their costs. And that's gone through the courts, and more recently, they've actually been denied that, which puts the entire project's viability into question. For projects like Sasan that are relying on domestic coal, there's been a huge Coalgate scandal that swept across India where coal allotments were given without, were basically just given away to the private sector. So the government lost out on huge amounts of money because of that. Now, the coal blocks for the ultra mega power plants, these six or so projects like Sasan, those have been exempted from that ruling, but we're talking about over 200 coal blocks. These are domestic mining rights within India. The court has said should be canceled, and the country is trying to figure out what that means. So the entire coal industry in India is really teetering on the edge. And again, what it's showing is that this preconceived notion that coal is cheap, that coal is a good investment, it's just not true anymore. And once we finally accept that coal is not the answer, then we can start talking about things that really can help solve the problem.
As we finish up, is there a blog or website where people can keep track of the work of Sierra Club India?
Yes. So the Sierra Club's international climate campaign, we don't actually have an office in India, but you can find us through the website www.sierraclub.org. We also have a blog called Compass. That's for this whole Sierra Club, but you can look at the international work that we're doing, and not just in India. Because we don't have boots on the ground in other countries, we partner with grassroots organizations, oftentimes grassroots organizations working in frontline communities affected by these projects, and we offer support where we can. How we got involved in Sasan was really working with people in India who started telling us about what was happening at this project on the ground. And this report is our effort to bring those voices to the forefront, voices that have often been ignored. And we've done a lot of work in other countries around the world. So if you look at www.sierraclub.org and the Sierra Club blog Compass, you'll find that information.
So I'll put links to all these resources in my own show blog at ecoshock.info. We've been talking with Sierra Club campaigner Nicole Gill. Thank you so much, Nicole.
Thank you. It's great being here.
I'm Alex Smith reporting for Radio EcoShock. Tired of cheerleaders and phony media issues?
We treat climate change almost as if it's something external. It's a sort of problem that we've created that we can solve with human genius. But I don't think it is. I think climate change is our society. Climate change is who we are.
Looking for the awful truth? Dig in with Alex Smith.
Actually, you're never going to get millions of people on the streets to campaign against climate change because they'll be campaigning against their own way of life. And so we're all complicit in that system. The voters are complicit, the corporations are complicit, the politicians are complicit, and we might want to stop climate change, but actually I don't think that we can, at least within the timescale that's apparently available to us. And I think we need to be honest about that, because only when we're honest about that can we start to think about what we do next.
Top scientists, authors, and activists, the ones you want to hear. No fear, Deep Green Radio EcoShock. Join us. When I read that the world is losing 2,000 hectares a day, almost 5,000 acres every day, of valuable farm soil to salt damage, I thought, aha, rising seas are impinging on the deltas. No, This is a completely different problem that I did not know about, brought on by human agriculture. Valuable cropland is disappearing just as our increasing population needs it most. Here to explain is lead researcher Manzoor Kadir. He's the Assistant Director of Water and Human Development at the United Nations University's Institute for Water and Environment and Health. He's based in Canada. Dr. Kadir has taught in Germany and Pakistan as well. He was a senior scientist at ICARDA, the well-known Global Agricultural Research Center. Manzoor Kadir, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
I didn't know about this agricultural risk. Could you please take your time and explain the process where plant-killing salt can develop on farming land?
Yeah, it's very actually interesting, but very straightforward phenomena. What happens is that all waters, they have salts in them. Even the fresh water, the good quality water that flows through rivers. So every water has salts. Just to give you an idea that if we irrigate a piece of land with a good quality water, say for instance to grow a crop like wheat or cotton, we basically add the amount of water that also adds salts to that land, which are between 1 to 2 tons per hectare. What I'm talking about, irrigation is needed in those areas where the rainfall is not sufficient to meet the crop water requirement. And this usually happens in dry areas, in arid and semi-arid areas, where the rainfall is less than the crop would normally need. So what happens that when we irrigate, part of the water is just evaporated from the soil. The other one goes into the soil from where the plants take up pure water with some nutrients, very minor amount of salts. The rest amount is left within the root zone. Same applies to evaporation process. When water evaporates from the soil surface, salts are left. So basically, if we irrigate in a dry area, we basically add about 1 to 2 tons per hectare with each crop of salt. So we need to manage these salts because these salts tend to accumulate in the soil surface and slowly they reach to that level which could become toxic or very high concentration where the plant growth may be affected. So if we continue accumulating salts in the root zone, the soils become salt affected. There are ways available to manage these salts, but this is how the salts accumulate in soil.
Well, first of all, I presume this wouldn't happen in nature without irrigated farming. Am I correct?
That's right. Yeah. The type of salinity that we are talking about is basically irrigation-induced. It's basically human-induced salinization, or we also call it as secondary salinization. There are soils available on this planet which have been developed from the parent material, which was salty itself. So those are different types of salt. We are talking about those soils which have been transformed into salt-affected lands because of the mismanagement of irrigation and salt.
Just so we can picture how serious this is, how big is the area lost to salt degradation since the early 1990s?
Actually, we are talking about the salt-affected lands in the irrigated agriculture only. Currently, there are about 310 million hectares irrigated land all over the world. And of that, about 20% is salt-affected. So meaning about 62 million hectares are affected by salts to a varying level. In 1990, this extent was about 45 million hectares. Just going through a simple calculation would lead us to a number which is equal to about 2,000 hectares are affected by salinity every day in irrigated areas.
And that's about the size of France, your press release said.
The size of the France is basically the overall salt-affected lands on this planet.
All right. Now let's talk about a couple of places where we wouldn't expect this to happen. For example, it's hard to believe that salt degradation is happening in Australia's breadbasket, the Murray-Darling Basin. Is it related to the extended drought that they experienced in past years?
No, this is not the case. Actually, in the Murray-Darling Basin, what happened that it's a long history. There was some of the area which was covered by forests and there was a natural equilibrium of salts. So those were actually removed and those lands were brought into cultivation. And by that, irrigation was also started. So with that actually irrigation and some other new area where there was no crop grown before, so those areas were brought under cultivation. And with the irrigation, with the gradual increase in the amount of salts added, as I already actually explained, so the salts tend to accumulate it in the Murray-Darling Basin. So then the Australian government undertook a very aggressive step and they developed a salinity management strategy, which is called as Murray-Darling Salinity Management Strategy. And then they installed the drainage system and removed the salt which was accumulated in the root zone. So now they have brought back significant area into a highly productive state from salt-affected land.
The United States prides itself on modern farming and can afford infrastructure like drainage. How can salt degradation be happening in the San Joaquin Valley?
In the San Joaquin Valley, it had the same actually issue because it also falls under arid and semi-arid area. And there, they wanted actually to increase the area under cultivation. And the rainfall was less than the crop water requirement, so they had to irrigate those lands. So initially, they didn't put the drainage system, but now they have installed a drainage system, and that's why they can now manage salinity in that area. Anywhere in the world where we will have to irrigate a piece of land, if we do not provide a drainage to remove the salts which are irrigated via irrigation water, sooner or later will end up in salinization of that soil.
How long would that process take? Do you know?
It depends, actually. There are different factors. The first one is the water quality itself. What is the quality of water that is being used? If the irrigation water already contains a lot of salts, so the process will be faster than an area where the irrigation water quality will be better, less amount of salts. Second, what is actually the level of groundwater? Because if the groundwater is very deep, you may not need a drainage system right at the beginning of the irrigation. Like if you look at the Indian subcontinent, where the large-scale irrigation started about a century ago, but the soil started becoming salt-affected after about four decades of irrigation because the groundwater levels were so low, so deep, that whenever the salts used to accumulate in the soil surface, so the farmers used to over-irrigate, to apply an excess irrigation that would push the salts down to the groundwater. The groundwater started moving up, up, and up. So a stage reached when the groundwater reached to a level where it started actually affecting the plant growth and the conditions of waterlogged soils appeared, which ultimately then again turned into salt-affected land. It also depends on climate conditions. Like in colder climates, there will be less evaporation. There will be less amount of water that would be used for irrigation. In hotter climates, there will be more water will be used for irrigation to grow the same crop. But at the same time, there will be more salts added to the soil.
And in some parts of the world, poor farmers just don't have the money to add this kind of irrigation and then the drainage as well. What is happening, for example, in Pakistan in the Indus Basin?
Actually, you see, the drainage system itself cannot be installed by a single farmer, particularly when we are talking about farmers in developing countries like Pakistan, because the salinity salt-affected lands or their effects are not just on the on-farm, they are off-farm also. So the farmers, what they can do, they can rationalize the amount of irrigation water, that they should not really apply too much water. Applying too much water means applying too much salts to the soil. The installation of a drainage system cannot be done at a small farm of hectare, something like that level in developing countries. So this is basically a collective kind of action at the irrigation district level or the basin level, where there is a need for a comprehensive study first to see what is the gradient of groundwater movement, how the drainage water could move, how one can actually collect that drainage water, what would be the disposal of that drainage water, and what will be the ultimate disposal of that salt that would be collected through drainage water. So this is basically beyond a farmer. There is a need for an action plan at a district level or a national level, like what has been done in Murray-Darling Basin or in San Joaquin Valley, where the governments took care of that. Similar measures have been taken in a country like Pakistan also, where when the groundwater level rose to alarming levels and the soil started becoming salt affected, then the government, with the help of international donors, they installed actually the vertical drainage system and the horizontal drainage system. But I'm talking about vertical drainage system, but they started actually pumping groundwater and moving that groundwater through drainage canals. This was again undertaken by the government, and those areas where these drainage systems were installed, slowly the farmers were able actually to grow the same type of crop with the similar type of productivity they used to have before the soil degradation process.
What happens to those farming communities if salt causes the land to become degraded?
Yeah, actually it depends on the scale of degradation. If the degradation is not too much, the farmers will still continue growing crops, although they will a little bit compromise on the crop yield. Then there are moderately salt-affected lands where some of the farmers will start actually growing crops varieties which are relatively salt-tolerant. There's a lot of work being done to develop salt-tolerant cultivars or varieties of crops. They would tend to grow those type of crops. The other approach, some of the farmers, they organize the crop rotation in a way that when the salts are actually more in the root zone, like in summertime, they can grow a salt-tolerant crop. In winter, when the salts are relatively less amount, then they grow a relatively moderately salt-tolerant or salt-sensitive crop. So there are interventions that the farmers can do. There are areas which, if they become completely actually degraded and the farmers don't see a benefit in cultivating that, and those areas are basically then abandoned. Those lands become salt-affected wastelands, and the farmers, then they simply move out of that land. And we know in several, actually, cases, then they go to a nearby city for labor work and other things. So migration also happens in case of extremely salt-affected lands.
Mansoor Qadir, do you have predictions of how widespread and how serious salt degradation of soils will become by 2050? Will we beat this problem with the drainage that you suggest, or do you think we're actually going to lose some land, possibly forever, more or less, to salt?
Actually, the publication that we have developed is targeted on decision makers. It's mainly a synthesis of the information that clearly highlights the importance of decision making in this regard. These lands are very important because they fall in irrigated areas where infrastructure is available, irrigation infrastructure is available, roads, everything is available there. And if we will not pay attention to these lands, and there are not actually many areas left which are productive outside the irrigation system. So basically, we will have to pay attention to these areas to revert them back to the productivity status. Now, the question is how this can be done. Our publication has clearly outlined that there is a need for supportive institutions who could do action on the ground. We need pertinent policies. We need a good level of economic analysis that could clearly demonstrate what are the existing costs and what could be the potential benefits out of that. The cost that we have suggested, $27 billion annually, are just based on the crop yield losses, because we do not have estimates on the damage to infrastructure, to roads, to buildings, decrease in land value and all that. We also need involvement of private sector, because there are so many industries which are directly linked to agriculture, like timber, pulp or paper industries. Those are directly dependent on agriculture produce. So there are a range of actors. If those can be mobilized, I'm quite confident that this land degradation process can be reversed. And those lands which we are talking about in irrigated areas can be reverted back to highly productive state. If we will delay or will not take any action, I'm afraid the scale of land degradation currently at 2,000 hectare per day may further actually increase. It's all actually up to us as an international community and to those governments where large-scale salinization of land and water resources has occurred.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, and my guest has been Dr. Mansoor Qadir. He's with the UN University's Institute for Water, Environment, and Health. Dr. Qadir, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your knowledge.
It was certainly my pleasure. Thank you so much for providing me the opportunity. All the very best.
We are out of time in this triple header EcoShock show. Get all the links in my show blog at ecoshock.info, all our past programs as free MP3 downloads at ecoshock.org, or listen live at our SoundCloud page. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you for caring about your world.